that music means we're back, and I don't know, it's very exciting here in the first tee of another episode of Swing Thoughts. Always great having you along with us. We certainly appreciate it. You know, I don't know if we say that enough. The coach and I, Coach Tim, and of course, I'm Golf Spiritual Leader. Why? Because I said I was. And I got there first. That's right. I was trying to explain that to somebody recently. Why do you call yourself that? I said, because it's stupid.
I thought of it.
Because it's a bit I thought of about 7 years ago, and I can't let go. We're really excited to have you all back with us. As I mentioned, we appreciate it, and we have a lot of gratitude around the people that, you know, reach out to us. And, of course, around the people that agree to participate on this program, we're going to get to another, you know, super guest, friend of show, Swing Thoughts Hall of Famer, coming up on the broadcast today. But, Timmy, first, of course, we have to thank all the people that make it. You know, why don't we start with our clothing sponsor first today, and then we'll end with a message from TaylorMade.
Yeah, let's shake it up. Yes, Howard and I are very fortunate to be able to wear the amazing polos by Oscar Bravo. And these things are amazing because we go into our clubhouse and we know that we look sharp. We are sharp-dressed men. Yeah. And that no one will wear the polos that we have on.
That's right. We know that.
Each year, they only make 100 of each style, and they are amazing. They have wonderful features. They wick away moisture, all that good stuff. So check out whoisoscarbravo.com.
Fantastic. And, of course, TaylorMade Golf has been such a kind and generous supporter for all these these many years. And let them tell you about their
experience.
Fine. Let them tell you about their fine irons.
Most game improvement irons are built to promote a miss to the right for right-handed golfers and a miss to the left for left-handed golfers. We believe that when you swing an iron, the only place your ball should go is right where you're aiming. That's why the new QI irons from TaylorMade are designed for straight distance. Schedule your fitting at TaylorMadeGolf.ca and see what it feels like to consistently hit your irons far and straight with the all-new QI irons from TaylorMade. We'll give it to you straight.
And speaking of irons, later on the program, after we get to our featured guest here in a second, we will address what I am now calling the Great Iron Cover Controversy. Like a lot of things in my life, I made some stupid offhand comment on our last broadcast, and the iron cover people have come out after me. And
they weren't just going to sit there take it.
I had no idea there was such passion for iron covers. But I did a little research, and by research, I mean I went on my computer. Let me just pause for a second. I love when people say that. Oh, I've done some research. Oh, did you? Did you go to a library? Did you go to some... Did you go to some institute? No, I just Googled it. So there is a very, very fine recent PGA Tour winner who also uses iron covers for a great reason, and I'm going to reveal that story later on in this program. In the meantime, please welcome back to our show. He's been a great contributor, a bit of a mentor in terms of the mental side of the game for both Tim and myself. Both of us have had the pleasure of not only knowing this gentleman, but having worked with him one-on-one, and I think you've even been certified by his program, right?
I haven't. I haven't quite had it tattooed on myself, but no, I'm very proud to be certified.
Yes, well, the website and the program is known as the Mind Factor, but the mind behind that is a very bright gentleman, and we always look forward to welcoming back Dr. Carl Morris, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, Dr. Carl.
Hello, Howard. It's good to be back. I feel like a veteran of the show now.
Oh, yeah.
After all that introduction.
Both of us have been lucky enough, me most recently, to be a guest on your program. For a long time, when you were first starting to do a podcast, it was called The Brain Booster. Mm-hmm. And recently, you've made a little switch or a pivot, as the kids like to say. And now it's called The Mind Caddy. So why don't we start with that? What was the impetus behind that?
I'd love to give you a really kind of in-depth intellectual answer to that, Howard, but the only reason is that the guy who promotes the Mindcaddy app for me said it would just make sense for the two things to be called the same, so we just blended it together. There's nothing more in depth than that to it, really, but it seems to have gone off okay. I don't think nobody's rang up and so far and said they're really annoyed about the show being called something different.
I can't find it. Where is it gone? You've changed it, because people hate change. So to be clear, it's called the Mind Caddy. Go and get it on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Tim?
So, okay, well, this is great, but talking to Carl. It's such in-depth conversation about this. But so Howard and I, we always have like about a 90-second conversation about what we're going to talk about on each podcast. And one was, I wonder if there's a change in philosophy or direction in terms of the podcast. But what are the things that are really, on your mind and you're curious about these days?
It's interesting that, Tim. I think we've discussed this in the past at times. I think if I was sort of reflecting on where I am now and where I used to be, was that probably in years gone by, I would work with players and perhaps give them lots of techniques and tools and things like that. And I think the more I've gone on, the more I think it's really important to sort of see what a player's perspective of the game is, and actually more about how the golf course is occurring to them, how the environment of golf is occurring to them. And if the golf course is occurring to you as a threatening player, I mean, this is something Fred told me 20 years ago, Fred Shoemaker. It only took me 20 years to sort of latch on to what he said. And I really think now that if the golf course is occurring to you as a threatening environment, you can do all the breathing, you can do all the techniques, which may have their place and they may be valuable at times, but I think unless you sort of really drill into that and find out what's going on with that, you're probably going to keep coming up short. And we touched on it, Howard, didn't we, in the conversation that we had last week when you came on my show, that it's how the game occurs to us that's the real key to this. That if you can go out there and play, and the game isn't just a reflection of you and your value as a human being in terms of a number on a scorecard, then I think we can start to make some progress. The rest of it is just tips and tools and techniques, as I say, which can be valuable, but not lasting in any way.
Well, we talked on a variety of subjects. One of the things I wrote down, and you and I sort of spoke a little bit at the end of my appearance on your program, which is what you resist. It's the idea of isn't there a phrase, what you resist persists?
Whatever you resist strengthens.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, and again, I play a lot of tournament golf. I played an event a couple days ago, and a lot of people have sometimes this feeling of the golf course being a threat, and their swing reflects that. And, in the middle of my round the other day, for a couple of holes, I got sort of weirdly tight, and my swing was a little bit off, and I could feel it. And I actually said to myself on the third hole, I said, okay. I was reflecting on this idea of turning it loose. I said, okay, on this tee shot, I just want to make as free a swing as you can. And it turned around for me, because for a couple holes, for whatever reason, I was resisting it. The dog leg didn't look right to me or whatever it was, but just the awareness that that's what was happening, that I wasn't a horrible person, that just I got a little uptight for a bit. But I think that persists for a lot of golfers a lot of their golfing lives.
It does, and I think two things that really kind of drive a lot of behavior and drive a lot of the misery that we've all encountered in golf over the years is craving and resistance. We crave a theoretically better future. We crave an outcome that if I could only get under 100, I'll be happy. If I could only win the club championship, I'd be happy. If I could only get on tour. And when I get on tour, if I can only win a tournament. And then when I've got to win a major. And if I win a major, I need to win another major. And we're kind of constantly craving a future that never actually comes to us. And then the the match up to that, or the relationship to that, is then the resistance of outcomes that don't seem to be moving you in that direction. And the problem is that we're resisting most of the time at golf, if not all of the time, we're resisting the inevitability of the game. And the inevitability of the game is from day to day, week to week, you're going to miss a lot of putts, you're going to hit some shots out of bounds, you're going to mess up in a bunker, you're going to do lots of things that you don't particularly like. But as you just said there, the more you resist it, the more we resist those experiences, the more we get in trouble. And the problem is, we're constantly seeking to protect ourselves from the feelings of poor shots. We're constantly seeking to protect ourselves from the feeling of failure. We're constantly seeking to protect ourselves from, you know, losing a card or whatever. And it's the resistance to those feelings that make us go in search of the perfect swing or the perfect technique, or, you know, fill in the blanks, whatever your search tends to be. And unfortunately, we never really get anywhere with that, because we're denying reality, and the reality is that you're going to mess up. You know, and it's that relationship to that I think is one, for me, when I'm working with players, that's a really interesting conversation now, is what is your relationship to those setbacks? What is your relationship to those outcomes? And it comes down to it, fundamentally, and this all begins to sound a little bit tree-huggy, which, and I don't know, we're not of that variety.
Oh, you've come to the right place, my friend.
Yeah. You know, it ultimately comes down to, Are you seeking validation as a human being through a golf score or a golf shot?
Absolutely.
And if you are, you'll be putting yourself under too much pressure, and you'll be putting yourself under pressure that nobody can withstand. You know, ultimately, we need to get to a place where that golf is something that you do, and you give it everything, and you try and win, and you try and do your best. But it's something that you do. It's not what you are. And I think that's a really, really important distinction.
Yeah, that's so much good stuff in there, Carl. One of the things that I find is that people, in terms of the people I work with, there's always kind of this draw towards trying something. Like you said at the outset, trying a tip or a technique. It could be breathing. I was talking to a client yesterday, and he was talking about freeing up his putting. And so he was thinking of a Fred Shoemaker exercise where you putt to a flag stick. Well, that didn't work for a couple holes, so he tried another similar type of thing. And I said, do you see how your compulsion to make you feel better, to quell your anxiety, it's making you engage in behaviors where you're trying to seek feeling better, you know, finding something that's going to, quote, work. I says, but really, all you're trying to do is you're just more in your head as opposed to trying to make a golf shot. Yeah. And it's when we're just trying to make a golf shot, and just whether it goes in or not or goes on the green, what unfolds, unfolds. Mm. But we just people tend to put so much, they invest so much of themselves in the outcome that I think that's what leads to this, as you say, craving and going around looking for things.
Well, I'm going to just piggyback on what you're saying and to relate to what Carl said a little bit, is that it's this seeking to become bulletproof so that you protect yourself. I don't know how you put it, but protecting yourself from feeling bad about a bad shot is, I think, at the very core. I think you've really nailed it. That's at the root of a lot of our issues with golf, even if we don't want to dig that deep. And I really believe you've nailed it there.
Yeah, and interesting what Tim's just said there. I call it try-itis.
Yeah,
you know, I'll try this, and that doesn't work, I'll try something else. And unfortunately, the modern world, and you know, maybe to a degree, we're all guilty of it as well. That the modern world is supplying us with so many things that we can try, so many options, so much information out there that when I would work with somebody 25 years ago, I'd obviously sit down with them and say, well, what are you working on? And they would, you know, they'd generally come up with a couple of things. Now, when I ask the question, what are you working on? I actually hold my breath and think, Christ, what's going to come out here? and you know, it's like 25 minutes later, they've done this, they've done that, they've worked a decade, and ground reaction forces, and this guy, and that guy. I think, my God, what have we done? And it's the very opposite, I think, of how anybody in the past went on a path of mastery. Because a path of mastery, whether that was in journalism or whether it was in surgery or whether it was in golf or whatever, you would generally work with a person or a limited number of people, and you would work with them, and you would perhaps study them, and you'd see what they did, and you would evolve as a result of staying with that process over a long period of time.
Right.
That seems to have gone out the window now.
Like an apprenticeship.
Yeah, like an intern or an apprentice. Exactly.
Like an apprenticeship, yeah.
But what do we say, and again, this, we kind of touched a little bit on it when I spoke to you about trying to, like, work on your golf swing so that you'll never hit another bad shot. You know, and which is such a false narrative around improvement. So I'll say to both of you, really, what do we say to somebody that's, why work on getting better at all? Or maybe a better question, or to phrase it, is what's a healthy way to work on getting better?
I'll go. One thing that I've been working, especially with players who really are struggling, let's say with chipping or putting or kind of, you know, yips, you know, heebie-jeebies. And I say, can we change what success is? Can we change success is that I'm more aware after this shot than I was before of what was happening.
Right.
And I think through developing your skill of awareness, you become more aware of what's actually happening rather than trying to shoehorn some concept, particularly technically, about what you're supposed to do and doing it right. So to me, when you increase your skill of awareness, now you know what you're doing, maybe the things that you weren't aware are out of your blind spots. To me, that's there's more growth that happens right there than trying to make your swing, quote, bulletproof. Carl?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Tim. And I also think a close relation to that would be to, I know we've touched on it before, but a close relation would be to get more involved in golf shots rather than golf swings.
Yeah.
You know, if you ask the question, what's wrong with my shots, we can go somewhere with that, because it's going too far to the right, to the left, it's too high, it's too low, it's starting this way, starting that way. We can really drill into golf shots. Most people are not asking that question, though. They're not asking what's wrong with my shots. They're asking what's wrong with my swing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure you guys have seen this. I've spent 40 years of my life walking up and down driving ranges, and I find it hilarious even to this day. I shouldn't find it funny anymore, but I still do. That, you know, you've got some guy on a range there with his pal, and these days they would, in 20 years ago, they would have had a copy of Golf World or something like that.
That's right.
They would have been looking at. Yeah. Now they've got, like, TrackMan and video cameras and all the rest of it. And this guy will launch it 70 yards right, and his mate jumps in and says, you didn't put any force into the ground on that one, or whatever the hell it is. And no, the face is open. That's what made the ball
That's
go
right.
to the right.
Whenever I see that on the range, it's like, I always think to myself, the blind leading the stupid. You know,
can you imagine that in any other field of endeavor?
No, and no other field would you take advice from your buddy who sucks worse than you do. But what I was going to say about golf shots, you know, I've been doing this for a while, and I was talking to a young aspiring, you know, tournament player. He's a golf pro. He's trying to get advancing. He was asking me about how I warm up. And I said, warming up is different than practicing. And once I get enough, you know, 10 or 12 wedges going till I finally get a little face contact, what I do then is I go through a few clubs in my bag, hitting to targets, hitting shots. If it's windy, how's my punch shot that day? Can I hit a high little soft cut? They're all shots. And what I said to him is, what it does is it engages my imagination, and my body knows, it'll figure out how to do that. Because the more I warm up, in quotations, by whatever I'm working on in my golf swing, the less ready I am to play the game that day.
I think also what you're doing is you're giving the brain really good data.
Yes.
About what you're seeking. I mean, it's hilarious to me. That some of the best shots you'll ever see when you play golf was in, when someone's in the woods.
Absolutely.
And they have to hit it between two trees, under the branch, land it, say, 50 yards short, and run on. And they hit this, you know, great shot because the brain knows what it needs to do. You put them out in the fairway, you know, clear shot, 145 yards, and they miss the green way left.
Yeah.
Why? Because they're not hitting a golf shot.
Right. And what I was going to say, when you stand there, when you stand on the range before a round and all you're doing is hitting seven irons or hybrids, and you're, all you're trying to do is whatever your teachers told you to work on, you're not warming up your game that day. And I'm telling you, I find it really, for me, before I go and play, I want to hit those shots because I'm going to have to hit, because I'm going to hit some bad shots in every round. But I was going to say back to Carl's point about the range. I almost never see anyone doing that. I even said to this kid, I said, you know, do you, before you go and play, make sure whatever first hole you're going to play, play that hole. At least play the tee shot. I'll tell you what, in tournament rounds, I do the whole routine. I actually, this is going to sound stupid, but I pretend they've announced my name and I get that little feeling. And then I walk up and I go through my entire routine that I'm going to need. In fact, and if I'll tell you the truth, if I don't hit a good one, I'll do it all over again because I want to feel by the time I've got to the first tee that I'm it's familiar to me. That routine is, I've practiced that. Not my swing, but the shot I'm going to hit on the first tee.
But that ties in, Howard, with this idea of just being really clear on a couple of key questions that you ask yourself. We just said, are you asking yourself, what's wrong with my swing? What's wrong with my shots? We know which direction we think is better. But on any given day, again, it's key the questions that you ask. If you ask yourself when you're warming up, what shots have I got today? I'll say to players, on it from day to day, you probably won't have your swing very often in the sense of your swing feeling great and everything being in sync and feeling fantastic. You won't necessarily feel good about your swing, but you'll always have shots. You'll always have shots that you can play. And if you say, if you stand on the range as you're warming up, asking yourself, what shots have I got? And you tune into that. You know, I've had some guys go out there and they've said they've shot some unbelievable scores with what they felt was just a couple of really quite ugly shots. But that day, they used those ugly shots really well, based the decisions around that, and then got the job done. And then who knows, tomorrow feels different. You know, why do we keep buying into this nonsense of consistency? When everybody's experience of the game is the total opposite, even the very best players in the world. You know, you get anomalies every now and again, like Scheffler and Tiger at his best. But I'm sure those guys would say that from day to day, they don't feel the same. But then when you spin it down and you get down the, you know, lower rungs of the game, especially club players, why on earth do we buy into this idea of consistency when we've never ever felt consistency? We've never experienced consistency because it doesn't exist. But the golf industry keeps filling us with this nonsense and this dream.
If I can, however, I'm sorry, finish your thought, because I was going to say I think I have an answer to why, but go ahead and finish.
No, I was just going to say, if we change the question or the goal from I want to be consistent to I'm going to be adaptable,
right?
I'm going to be adaptable to you know, whatever I'm feeling that day, because some days you feel shitty and some days you feel great, and you know, some days you're more alert than others, but that's okay. Some days you're more anxious than others, but that's okay. It's embracing the full, you know,
the
horizon of human experience, spectrum of human experience.
But the adaptability comes from, back to what we said at the beginning of this program, that to be anti-fragile is to be okay with whatever comes, whatever shot shows up. But I think the reason that a lot of the club golfers on up think that there is consistency, that nirvana of hitting the same way all the time, is because they mistakenly think that good players are hitting it good all the time. You know, I played a couple weeks ago with a couple really, really, like a plus three handicap, and I watched him play a couple rounds. We played in a tournament together, and it looked to me like he never missed a shot, but I know that's not true. And to someone who's never played with me, it looks like I don't miss a shot, but I do. It's just that our misses look better to them. Like, we look at tour players and think, well, they hit every shot on the button. No, they don't.
No.
It just looks like they do.
Was, it was Hogan, wasn't it, who said,
yeah,
you know, maybe the most, you know, Hogan and Mo Norman and one or two others,
Trevino,
maybe the most Trevino, the most competent players of all time, or the most skillful players of all time, you know. And Hogan, I don't know, it's down in folklore as him saying that he never hardly hit more than three shots a round where he felt he'd hit them exactly as he wanted. Now, as you say, Howard, his perception of good and bad would be different from a lot of other people, but even the best of the best of the best is still missing it relatively most of the time.
Most of the time, exactly. And that's why that false narrative exists. You know, I played with a couple of really good, nice players on Saturday in our little club matches, and they're like 7 and 14 handicaps, and they thought I hit it great. I didn't. But it, you know, to them, it looks like you're hitting everything on the face of the club, and you're not. That's why people are trying needlessly to become, you know, robotic in their ball striking, thinking that if they could just do that, then nothing bad will happen.
Yeah, well, I think yeah. part of it is a cultural thing that, I'm going to use this word, idolatry. We think that Hogan was perfect. Yeah. We think we go into the self-help section of a bookstore, and we think that whoever's selling the book on how to be happy is perfect. Nobody's effing perfect. We're all really fucking messy as human beings.
Come on,
it just happens. And so we make this mistake of thinking that, oh, if we buy that book or that program or listen to this guru on YouTube, we'll approach their level of their plane of existence, which is obviously higher than mine, you know, because I'm just Joe Schmo, and this is, you know, obviously some great star. That's why they have this platform. It's just not true. Everybody F's up. Everybody can screw up. So in golf, I think what we get caught up is we idolize these people and we see them as being haves and us have nots. And so we start searching for the things that will bring us to their level. And we're investing in things that don't exist.
I find a really useful model for players to perhaps think about, you know, some of the listeners can think about, is that if you look at any round of golf that you play, when you go out there on the golf course, you're going to constantly be experiencing one of three types of golf shot. So you're either going to hit good shots, you're going to hit good enough shots, and you're going to hit some poor shots. And what I would ask everybody to consider is, what is your current relationship to those three types of shots? Now, this is a sweeping generalization, but my experience is when players get to a reasonable level, the relationship between those three shots gets very, very dysfunctional, in the sense that there's no appreciation, there's no joy with the good shots, because that's what you should do. The middle one is the big one. They really struggle with understanding. You need to acknowledge the good enoughs. You can produce some amazing scores at this game with just a lot of good enoughs. Good enough to hit the fairway, good enough to hit the green, good enough to be somewhere near the hole. And then the last one is, what's your relationship with the poor shots? Because they're going to happen. You know, there's not, as we've been saying now, and we've probably said before, and we'll be saying if you wheel me out in 10 years' time on this podcast, we'll still be having this conversation. The reality is, you're going to hit poor shots on a regular basis in abundance. It's not the poor shot that's the issue. It's the relationship to the poor shot that's the issue. And if you can examine that, and then you get into, you know, acceptance, and perhaps the ultimate mental skill of acceptance. And that's not giving up or not wanting to play well or being happy at shanking it or anything like that. It's a willingness to accept the reality of the variety of outcomes that the game throws at you. And I think when we sport, Howard, you know, you are now, your relationship to that poor shot from what you were talking about last week is very, very different, isn't it, than it was 10, 15 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the biggest improvement in my game. It hasn't come from better golf swings. It's come from a better relationship with the inevitable vagaries of the game. Full stop. Biggest improvement. Because, you know, when I first met Tim, I was only a couple of swings away from completely melting down at any moment on the golf course. And now it's just never an issue. I don't like hitting a bad shot, but it doesn't. There's no visceral cortisol spike. It's a practice. You know, I practiced it. I was very conscious of it for a long time. And now it's to an unconscious level where I sort of internally shrug when it happens. And conversely, like our friend Kent Osborne talks about in a lot of his stuff, I celebrate good shots. When I make a putt, even if it's just, you know, for no reason, I get excited because that's the reaction I want to imprint on my brain. And the okay shots, again, very neutral, kind of like, yeah, I can play that. That's still in play.
I love that. And I mean, used to see that with Tiger. When you'd see a shot and he'd just twirl the club, you could just see it. And you're just like, that's his way of imprinting or, if as you say, anchoring. But it's one of the things I find so fascinating. Here's the second Fred Shoemaker reference of the day. He says, if you're going to play golf, you better have a very good relationship with failure. Yeah. Just to be able, as you say, to accept what's going on, as opposed to this shot. You know, I shouldn't hit a shot like this. I was talking to a client this week. He's got a really nice round going. He's even on the front 14th hole. He cold tops a wedge, and that just led him to a downward spiral. Like, what am I doing hitting a shot like that? I'm not this kind of a player. And I just said, did you just see how you responded there in terms of like this relationship you have with what's going on? If you can just kind of roll with that and reference Howard, who says, well, that just happened, you know, or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's just such a different thing. But again, Carl, what you were saying earlier, it's like how we identify ourselves with our shots and our sense of competency and all of that. It's just, it is so hard, but that's, you know, golf is life. Life is golf.
You know, it is often said, golf's a metaphor for life. It isn't. It is just life, isn't it? And your relationship to poor shots is going to mirror your relationship to setbacks in life. And I think, again, unfortunately, when I'm seeing it more and more, you know, I've had some experiences these last couple of years with younger players, and being out on the golf course, and I'll walk some holes with them, you know, and I can see that tears on the golf course and tantrums and all the rest of it. And part of me gets really annoyed at that behavior, but also afterwards I reflect on it and think, my God, what have we done that somebody's sense of worth is so attached to what a golf ball does that it destroys them, it destroys their person, destroys how they feel about themselves in that instance on the golf course. And I think it also ties back to what we were saying before, this idea of I'll be happy when.
Yeah.
That's so pernicious, isn't it? It's not just in golf, it's in life in general. And when are we going to... Can I swear on this show as well?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. For you swing thoughts, here's the funny thing now, because I keep track. So far, O'Connor's got two effings, one fuck, no gollies or goshes yet, but they still have another 25 minutes. Yeah, you can say fuck all you want.
Yeah, I was going to say, when are we going to effing wake up to the fact that the only chance that we're going to be of being happy is if we appreciate what we've got right now? Now, if you appreciate what you've got right now, that actually is a great foundation to then springboard to somewhere that you think you might want to go.
Well, and it's a couple quick things before Tim jumps in. Like, there's such, and I was the worst I ever met, so much self-worth and identity. And, you know, Carl and I talked about separating Raymond's thing about separating self from craft. I couldn't, there's so much of that wrapped up in golf. How it started, I don't know. I thought that I would only be happy if I could, and when I did, play well. And maybe it's getting older. I know, maybe part of the aging process is realizing, like, I don't know, maybe today could be my final round. So I'd better enjoy the moments that were out there. But, you know, how do you relay that to somebody who's just getting started in golf and thinks they have, you know, thousands of rounds in front of them? Timothy?
Well,
no, what were you going to jump in with? You don't have to answer that question.
Okay, well, it was interesting. I had some similar conversations this week with some clients, two of them talked about having crucial shots. And it was as if I was going like, whoa, okay. Like, you know, quite obviously they're talking about, say, maybe it's a two-person match thing and they need to make a four-footer to have the match or whatever. And that is crucial. And I think if you dig deeper, it's as you were saying earlier, Carl, how you perceive the environment. This crucial shot is a test of me. You know, how will I show up? Mm-hmm. Am I competent? Have I practiced enough? Am I an individual who can rise to the occasion and live under the quote pressure? And so I just ask people, like, why is it crucial? I mean, if you think about a PGA Tour player who plays all four rounds, the lip out on Thursday afternoon is just as crucial as the four footer to win the event on Sunday.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is what we've been saying, that a lot of people's self-worth is wrapped up in how they appear, you know, as golfers. I played in a tournament last weekend on the 35th hole of a 36-hole. I had to make the cut. And on the 35th hole, I double bogeyed the hole. And I missed the cut by two. Now, an earlier version of me would have spent the rest of the day beating myself up because I double bogeyed that hole. But and I thought, how I put it in perspective now is exactly what you said. I could have double bogeyed any hole in that round. And it was a tough hole. And for me, I'm playing the back tee, so it's a long hole. So I just happened to double bogey that one at that moment. But I left there, like, no worse for wear, because I just said, well, you know, that's a hole that I'm probably going to bogey a lot of the times. And I just happened to double bogey it. And yeah, it was a drag. I missed the cut, but I didn't punch the inside. Didn't punch the inside of my windshield, because an earlier version of myself would have spent all the day punching the inside of my windshield, because I would have thought it was a huge failure. But I went, you know, I could double bogey any hole. It just happened. And I think that for me is the biggest difference in how I approach the game, is that, you know, I'm comfortable and I know that those will happen at any given time, and I can still go home and watch, House of the Dragon.
I think also it's important, you know, for anybody listening, we're not saying for 1 minute that, you know, oh, just go out there and don't give a shit about anything. just lash away at it. You know, this is still, you can still be on a path where you're trying to self-mastery, I suppose. You're still trying to become the best player that you can possibly be. But underneath it all, it's kind of like what you first of all got to do is you first of all got to shatter the illusion that it really means that much, that it really is life or death. You've got to shatter that illusion. You've got to create a different perspective for yourself and then recreate the illusion that actually I want to go out and give the best of myself, and I want to go and try as much as I, you know, shoot the best score I can and be actually actively involved in hitting as many good shots as possible.
Well, Carl, I want to ask you, I mean, what we've been talking about is kind of like what we call the club golfer, you know, and how... Yeah. How he or she can get really bent out of shape. But what's your experience with, I mean, you've coached people like Louis Oosthuizen and Darren Clark, Lee Westwood. I mean, you know, people have won major championships. How do they generally respond to, say, quote, losing a tournament, as we watch Rory do at the US Open with those two short putts, or, you know, a double bogey near the to lose, you know, either major tournament? And to these players, this could mean hundreds of thousands of dollars. It could mean, you know, an appearance in the Masters or not, all this kind of stuff, ranking points. How do you find that the players that you've worked with, the notable ones, how they respond to the vagaries of the game, particularly, quote, failure?
I mean, obviously, everybody's individual with it, Tim, but I think the main thing would be that, again, we're back to perspective, the perspective that they bring to them. And I've said to more than one player over the years, when they've had instances like that, because every player generally has at some point, you know, I said, we've got a choice here right now. We're at a T-junction, and the T-junction, you can turn left and you can wallow in this and you can keep beating yourself up and blaming yourself and valuing your capabilities, or you can actually look at it and say, I got so close. I was doing this and this really well. What do I need to do to improve? Because, again, the key message for everybody here is there's nothing wrong in trying to develop your skills. Looking at the skills that you need to work on to become a better player, that's the opportunity then. You know, and ultimately, your success in any endeavor doesn't come down to what you think. It comes down to what you do. And it's the actions that you take then. And I think anybody who's dwelling sort of pity party and the wallowing in the misery of what has happened, as opposed to, okay, what am I going to do about this? And it's the ones who say, what I'm going to do about it, that then move on and usually bounce back.
You know, one of the, and I'm just going to give you a plug for the Lost Art books. There's the Lost Art of the Short Game, Playing Golf, and the Lost Art of Putting. And one of the distinctions that you and Gary Nichol make is there's a difference between being childlike in your approach to the game and being childish. And you've just illustrated that. A lot of us become childish in that we stamp our feet and say, you know, I can't believe this. You know, I play with a lot of guys who'll say like things like, oh, you should have seen me drive it yesterday. And I always say, yesterday's a long time ago, my friend. Yesterday's a long way away in golf. But that's a lot of our behavior, as you've pointed out in your books, that a lot of golfers' behavior is childish.
Childish, yeah. You know, childlike is being fascinated. Being fascinated by creating this particular shot in this particular moment, really tuning into what the golf course is asking of you. I think that the more detached that we are from the golf course, the more we've got away from where we need to be. Because the golf course is just, if you think about what is around a golf, the golf course is just setting you a series of puzzles to solve. This is, you know, and people love doing puzzles, don't they? You know, people will sit and do a crossword for 2 hours, and you know they wouldn't do a crossword, and if they can't get seven across, just sort of, you know, get up and beat the shit out of themselves.
Well, wait a second. I might have, but a normal person wouldn't. I get what you're saying. Point taken. You know, that's such a great analogy. The idea that it's, you know, Sam Harris has a great bit about how, you know, did you think today would be the day you would have no problems to solve? And conversely, human beings love it, as you pointed out. All our lives are is a series of, oh, my, so I didn't charge my phone, or I forgot to pay this bill, or something's wrong in the house. Why would we expect golf to be any different? But we do.
Well, the thing that I used to do all the time was I'd have, let's say, a chip shot or something, a 20-foot chip shot. And I'd kind of look at it, and then my focus would go on, okay, I got to keep my right wrist hinged. I got to keep my weight on my left foot and make sure I accelerate. And then I hit the chip shot and went, oh, I didn't notice it was uphill.
That's right.
You know, and yeah, leave it 15 feet short, you know? Yeah. And so it comes back to the business of hitting shots and solving the puzzle. So like that's what I love about golf, is that every shot is different, and what we're trying to do is kind of figure out, okay, the pin's over here, we got some water here, we got a bunker there, where would I hit this shot, where would it best for this to land, and how could it, you know, trickle out of the grass. To me, that's where this fixation on golf swings and doing it right is, it's just, it really isn't in line with the objective of golf. We lose it. Is the fact is that, okay, you got a shot here, you got to figure that one out. Never mind how you're going to effing do it.
And I think when you change your mindset to going out there aiming to solve a bunch of problems, there's an endless fascination with that. You become curious about it. You become curious about your options. You get into the shots that you're trying to play. I would say for everybody listening, just the next few rounds that you go out, just see how many problems you can solve. If you look at it not so much even in terms of the number on the scorecard, just go out and think, how many problems can I solve? If you hit a fairway, you've solved the problem. If you hit a green, you've solved the problem. If you splash it out the bunker, you've solved the problem. And just get really curious about that, of what you can do on that day to solve a bunch of separate problems.
Well, as always, Carl, you've solved the problem of us providing great information and another entertaining guest for our Swing Thoughts devotees, or STDs as I call them. Carl's podcast, as we now know, is called The Mind Caddy. Don't read anything into that. It just aligns with his app. And in a couple of weeks, if the podcast still exists, I'm looking forward to hearing how I set you back by rambling on with you for 45 minutes. But thank you for your time today. We always appreciate it, my friend.
Great. great. It's great to be with you. Always enjoy the chat. Thanks, fellas. It's
Dr. Carl, Morris. Don't forget all about the Lost Art of Golf, Lost Art of Putting, Lost Art of the Short Game, and The Mind Factor. Go to find all things Carl at themindfactor.net. Sound of the river, you're stopping your hole. Da 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 da.
Well, always fascinating with Carl. Well, I love the fact that on our show, when he's a guest, we're able to sort of explore his views of playing the game and our relationship to it. As opposed, like on Mindcademy, it's a wonderful show in which he has all kinds of interesting guests. But often he's exploring their, you know, what they've discovered, what
their philosophies.
Exactly. Yep. So I love the fact that we get to go a little bit deeper in what Carl coaches his players and what he's thinking about.
I mean, there's so much great stuff there. The idea of, you know, golf being a source of, like, you know, we're always craving something. We're craving some kind of consistency, and I don't think people who play the game would articulate it that way. They think they want to have a consistent swing. But I've come to believe that what they subconsciously want is a consistent experience devoid of calamity. And
well, yeah, exactly.
And that's why we get so fucked up with it, because there's no day, very few days that we have on the planet that are devoid of some kind of calamity. And by the way, yeah. I just like saying the word calamity, but in that way, calamity. I even in my best rounds of golf, and I've had a couple of good ones lately, you know, where, you know, I was going pretty good last week, shot even par. But at some point in that round, I was kind of going, ooh, look at the how man, my shooting under par. And then I had a couple of chaotic holes where I, you know, it just happens. And to your talking about your fellow there that was even par, and then on the 14th hole, you know, skull fucked a wedge, that's what I call it, and that was the end of the round. But as another, you know, friend, Coach Paul Henrik, used to tell me, when people talk about, well, I'm, you know, I was two over after 14 holes, and he would say, no, you're not. You still haven't signed the card yet. You're nothing right. yet, because you don't know how the next three or four holes are going to go.
Yeah, exactly. Golf is funny that way. It's always this work in progress. But I mean, that's part of what we do. We create these narratives to I'm doing great today. Yes. Oh, today nothing's going well. Or how can I fuck this up? There's always this story that's going. I remember a couple of years ago, I was playing an early morning round by myself, and I made two late bogeys on the front, so I'm three over, and I birdie 10 11 12. What's my first thought? Can't wait to tell Howard.
Yeah, exactly. Great. Yeah, it's like you start, I do that too. You know, we all start building the story of our rounds, sometimes immediately, and it's a habit that I've tried to, you know, get out of, because that's what the word narrative is, story. You know, we're building a story of that day, and we're like, whether you tell me or it's the thing I'm going to tell people, you know, what we're going to tell our friends after, it gets in the way of being. And you made a really good point when we were talking about there with Carl about being in the moment where you were going through your Rolodex of how to hit a chip shot, and you didn't consider that it was uphill. Happens all the time, because you're going through the how to, not, you know, what's the shot here, given this specific lie. Yeah, you know?
Exactly. But I just see that all the time. I'm working with someone on the range, and say they're warming up, and then it's okay. And I said, oh, what are you trying to do here? He goes, I'm trying to hit it solid.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Are you not hitting to a target? You're not trying to land the ball some way or shape it a certain way? No, I'm just trying to hit it solid. Okay, you get that, but that's not the objective in golf.
Right.
Well, you don't get scored on hitting it solid. It's how you get it close to the, you avoid the water, you get it on the green and set yourself up for another.
Well, that's
shot.
What I was saying about warming up, that I try and warm up my game, not my golf swing. I love going to practice my swing and videotape myself and, you know, working to see if I'm making any progress on what I'm working on. But before a round, I'm trying to like, okay, if I have to hit a little draw 6-iron today, do I have that? Or especially around my golf course, which is perennially windy. Do I have that little 6-iron punch shot that I sort of have? When's the last time I hit that? Oh, I haven't hit it in a few days. So I'm going to try and hit it now. Before we finish, though, today it's the we want to address the great iron cover controversy.
Oh, okay.
Now,
yes.
I don't know what I said. I think we were talking about things like, you know, weird, quirky things on the golf course. Like I won't use a if somebody leaves their tee in a par three, I won't use that.
Yeah.
And then I said something about iron covers. So this is from Peter Hooper, who says, "Hello, Tim. I just listened to your podcast with HH. I use iron covers on every other iron. Two reasons. I don't like the tiny dents in my forged irons from them hitting each other. And I prefer the sound of silence instead of clanking steel when walking, which I always do. Most of my friends don't consider me eccentric." And then he put a little smiley face there. So I don't know if that's true or not. But, all right, Peter, you know, use the iron covers all you want. I'm not an iron cover guy myself.
Would you be accepting? And it's Peter Hopper, but...
Is it Hopper?
It's Hopper.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, Peter. Hooper.
Yeah. But, you know, I think if we...
I only had one thing to get right was his name. Sorry, Peter Hopper. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I actually played some golf with Peter. That's why he, like, years ago, and, I'm not sure if he had iron head covers at the time, but if I was playing with, I think I mentioned on the last show, I played with a guy last year in the Senior Ryder Cup. Mm. I mean, nice fella, and it didn't. But it is funny. I think part of it is kind of like part of our culture is, well, this is different.
Yeah,
and we struggle with what's different, and. It's just, I don't know, it's just funny, but it's almost like the iron head covers, there's this distinction that, oh, this means this person's kind of fussy, you know, kind of maybe, you know, kind of odd or very careful, but I don't think it's really any of that, but I think that's not an uncommon perception of things like that.
No. Well, listen, it's unusual. And after I read you this next thing, I'm going to hate on iron covers less. So, you know, you don't want to talk about, our, you know, something that's a bit quirky or odd. Aaron Rye, who just won the PGA Tour event last weekend, uses two gloves, which that's I've right. always thought was a little bit weird. And I don't know if you know this, but KO, Kent Osborne, Guru Kent, when I first met him, was also using two gloves.
Oh, do you remember Tommy Two Gloves?
Tommy Two Gloves, exactly.
That's right.
But Kent was one of the first people I'd ever met, like a guy that I was going to play golf with. And he doesn't do it much anymore, and I have to ask him why. But I don't think he has iron covers. I mean, that would be too much for me. So Aaron Rye has two gloves. And I found out, doing some research, that he also has iron covers. I Googled it. was Googling something, Googling iron covers, and the story about Aaron Rye came up. And he apparently has iron covers as well. He said, "My dad used to pay for my equipment. He paid for my membership. He paid for my entry fees. And it wasn't money that we really had. He grew up, you know, fairly poor." He says, "But to be honest, he'd always buy me the best clubs. He used," this is talking about his father, "my father used to clean every single groove with a pin and baby oil, and to protect the golf clubs, he thought it would be a good idea to put iron covers on them. And I've pretty much had iron covers on all my sets ever since, wait for it, just to kind of appreciate the value of what I have." And I was like, all right, iron cover people, you've won me over. You've tugged at the old GSL's heart, and I'm down now.
Isn't that yet another lesson in judgment?
I just thought that was such a... I mean, what a great thing. The guy's a tour pro. He's worth millions of dollars, and he still puts iron covers to honor his father's commitment. Thank you, Aaron Rye. And I am today's official worst person in the world. Anyway...
Oh, well, I think you're amazing, but you know.
Well, I know.
It's your own stuff that you're dealing with, so good luck with that.
Yeah, man. Well, listen, everybody, hope you're all having a great August. The heat seems to have abated, and now we're into my favorite part of the year to play golf. And I've got a few rounds of significance still to come, quite a bit of tournament golf in September and a little bit here in August. But and what about you? You're busy teaching people, and you're busy working with people, changing lives.
And finishing up the book, Seven Shawarma Recipes.
seven Shish Kebab Ideas for the Barbecue. Are we getting any closer, or is this just one of those ongoing sagas?
No, we're very close to the finish line. This is, I've just finished this morning proofing the third draft. And it's amazing. I mean, this thing has been gone through all kinds of people. I've been through it now, like I probably read it six times, you know, proofing it. And that, you know, that's for like, looking for typos, grammar, dropped words. But it's funny, on the very last page of the book today, and again, how many times I've been through this damn thing, I noticed that my Substack URL was wrong. It said T. Connor as opposed to T. O'Connor. Oh, really? I mean, oh, but we're that close, so we're going to launch it in September. And okay. No, it's very close, and soon you'll be able to find all the shish kebab recipes.
Yeah,
you
I can't
want.
Wait. You know, and then I'm going to be like, hey, Tim, when's the audio book coming out? You'll be like, ah, fuck. Can't do the audio. It'll be next year, and then the movie. Thanks to Carl Morris, as I mentioned, mindfactor.net, Tim O'Connor, the Substack, and everything else at o'connorgolf.ca. This program is produced by the Humble and Fred Limited Company, and we're on vacation this week. We'll be back next week, and of course, thanks to secretlinks.golf, TaylorMade Golf Canada, and of course, whoisoscarbravo.com. We'll both see you next week, I think. All right?
Everything. Bye-bye.
So long.
A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time.